are paper tigers, and that Russia is the sole and dominant power on the earth.
47. Luganov had their attention now. Everyone grunted approval. Yet as Luganov explained his plan, Alek saw many of the expressions change ever so discreetly. What the president was proposing was a full invasion and occupation of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, followed by formal annexation of each. Immediately afterward, snap elections would be held, whereby the populations of the Baltic states would vote to rejoin the Russian Federation, voluntarily, Luganov insisted, so they could enjoy all the rights and privileges of being full Russian citizens. Luganov said he wanted to launch his blitzkrieg using 27 battalions, roughly 21,000 soldiers, to seize Estonia and Latvia. Based on his calculations, he believed they could reach and capture the capitals of Tallinn and Riga in just 60 hours. He said another 15 battalions, nearly 12,000 troops, would be needed to wrest control of Lithuania. He proposed attacking through Belarus and from the Russian territory of Kaliningrad, west of Lithuania and north of Poland. He believed they'd need another 2 days to capture and adequately control the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius. At this point, the president opened a leather binder and handed out copies of a 10-page war plan he had drafted himself. He walked his team through the document. The first few pages laid out specific tactical objectives, such as roads, power plants, and cities that needed to be taken, by which battalions, and by what specific dates and times. It also laid out a time frame that nearly made Alek's jaw drop. The president wanted to launch the attack no later than the end of October. That was just 4 months away. The next few pages included maps and suggested routes of attack. The last two pages raised specific questions to which the president said he expected detailed answers by their next meeting, set for the following day. Luganov wanted to know from his foreign minister whether he believed the president of Belarus would agree to a snap joint military exercise inside his territory, and what kind of sweeteners might be needed to get Minsk on board. He wanted to know how quickly the defense minister could put together exercises for 100,000 or more troops on the border of Ukraine, in order to divert attention and make it seem like he might actually go for a full invasion not of the Baltics, but rather Ukraine, in the hopes of seizing Kiev, which he had recently and very publicly called the mother of all Russian cities. From the chief of the Air Force, he wanted to know how many squadrons of bombers and fighter jets he could safely move from the eastern military district near China to the western MD without creating a significant vulnerability on the eastern front, how quickly this could be accomplished, and whether it could be done discreetly enough not to immediately draw the attention of the Pentagon. From his FSB chief, he wanted to know what kind of progress had been made in surreptitiously providing automatic weapons, ammunition, and explosives to Russian loyalists in each of the Baltic republics, and whether they had the proper communications equipment to be mobilized when the time was right. For several minutes, the room was silent, and from Alek's vantage point, quite tense, while the men absorbed the plan and considered the implications for the nation and for themselves. The chief of the army was the first to raise his hand, and the president actually looked pleased to take the general's question.
"Mr. President, just to be certain I understand, you are asking us to seize Tallinn and Riga in 60 hours?
He asked. The question made it clear to Alek that this was the first time the army's most senior and experienced commander was hearing of the plan.
"Yes," Luganov confirmed. and Vilnius within another 48 hours.
You are asking us to capture and occupy 3 NATO capitals?
And secure their annexation, so that they might be rightfully reintegrated into Mother Russia, the president said.
But not Kiev.
Not right now.
Would it not be in our interest to seize all of Ukraine instead?
Asked the general.
The Ukrainians are very patriotic, and they're able fighters, but they are not members of NATO. Washington and Brussels will huff and puff, but in the end they will do nothing if we take Ukraine. I have wargamed this with my staff. I'm convinced we could get it done in a month to 6 weeks.
But we can have the Baltics in 4 days, Luganov replied with a rare but telling smile. Again the room was quiet. Then the Army Chief of Staff pressed forward.
How is it in Russia's interest, if I may ask, to provoke such a confrontation with NATO, when Ukraine is ours for the taking, with no risk of triggering Article 5?
Alek saw the smile disappear instantly from the president's face. The general was speaking of the mutual defense pact that lay at the heart of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's charter. Article 5 stated that each member of NATO would consider an attack against one member state to be an attack against all. Any hostile action against any NATO member would, therefore, obligate the entire alliance to bring its combined political, economic, and military power to bear to repulse such an attack. No state was alone to fend off the bear by itself. It was all for one and one for all. During the Soviet era, Alek knew, it was this very alliance that had stopped Russian leaders from invading any part of Europe, lest they trigger war with the West that could all too easily go nuclear. Now Luganov was proposing to invade 3 NATO countries simultaneously.
General, are you afraid of NATO?
Luganov fumed, his face growing red as he leaned forward in his chair.
I am not. Just the opposite. I believe they are afraid of me, and rightly so. They are fat and lazy. They are weak and divided. Their day is over. Our day has come. We are strong and getting stronger. We have modernized our strategic forces. We have rebuilt our conventional forces, all while they have downsized their own. So we will storm into the Baltics with such speed and force that the leaders in the White House and at SHAPE headquarters and around the globe will shake in fear. They will not know what has just hit them. They won't dare threaten us with nuclear war, for they know I am willing to unleash our nuclear power upon them. And when this simple truth dawns on them, that I am a man of action and they are cowards, they will surrender the Baltics without a fight. And that, gentlemen, will be the end of NATO. If they do not trigger Article 5, and I guarantee you they will not, then I will have won a great victory for our people. We will be the world's only superpower, the only nation on the planet that has a great military and the courage to use it. I alone will have the power to dictate economic and political terms to the West. And we will see riches and glory unparalleled since the days of the Tsars.
48. Washington, D.C., September 17th. The day started just like any other. Marcus Riker woke before dawn and ran his usual 5 miles. Returning to his apartment in Eastern Market,
He showered, threw on a pair of ripped jeans, a denim work shirt, and steel-toed boots, and walked to a diner a few blocks from Capitol Hill. There he sat alone in a booth in the back and ordered scrambled eggs, dry toast, and black coffee. He read the Post from cover to cover, then, unable to take any more bad news, trudged over to Lincoln Park Baptist Church. For the last few weeks, he'd been helping put a much-needed new roof on the 137-year-old building. By noon, the sun was beating down from a cloudless sky, and Marcus was drenched with sweat. He took a swig from his water bottle, checked his watch, and decided he could still get another 20 to 30 minutes of work in before stopping to wash up for his weekly lunch with Carter Emerson and some vets who attended the church. They didn't talk about war. They didn't talk about loss. They certainly didn't talk about politics or women. Most of the conversations were about whether the Nats were still in contention for the playoffs, and whether the Redskins, or, in Marcus's case, the Broncos, had any shot at all at a winning season, to say nothing of going to the Super Bowl. Marcus was bending over to retrieve his hammer when Nan Warren shouted to him and asked if he could come down a few minutes early. Nan was Carter Emerson's secretary. She was the one whose name Marcus had blanked on the day of the memorial service. Yet for at least 3 months after Elena and Lars's deaths, she had faithfully brought him a home-cooked meal, usually meatloaf, always on Mondays. Her husband, Jim, was one of the vets Marcus had lunch with on Wednesdays. They had all become friends. "Be right there," Marcus called back. He assumed Carter wanted to see him before the lunch meeting. Though he'd never let on, he felt a pang of annoyance at being summoned early. There were already forecasts of big thunderstorms rolling in over the next few days. If he was ever going to get this roof done, he needed fewer breaks and more focus. Yet that wasn't the way Carter and his team rolled.
"Jesus wasn't about projects. He was about people," Carter would say with a hearty laugh whenever Marcus mentioned his concern about the roof's progress. "Love your neighbor, not your work."
Marcus didn't care much for such platitudes. A big part of the reason he was working on the roof was to avoid people. Then again, he was pretty sure Carter was on to him and was intentionally trying to get him engaged with as many people as possible. That had to be why he'd asked Marcus to do odd jobs around the church in the first place, starting on the very day Marcus had turned in his letter of resignation to the Secret Service. It also had to be why Carter was always calling him down from the roof to have some lemonade together, or meet a brother, or fix a clogged toilet, or listen to and critique the latest draft of his next sermon, or have a slice of Maya's crazy good key lime pie. As annoying as it was sometimes, Marcus was also grateful. This man and his dear wife loved him, and were doing their best to keep him from hitting rock bottom. After descending the ladder and taking a few minutes to wash his hands and face, Marcus exited the lavatory in the church basement and went to the third floor, where Nan was sitting at her desk.
"Go right on in, young man," she said with a warm smile. "He's waiting for you."
When Marcus rapped on the door, heard a hearty "come in," and stepped into Carter's cluttered office, he was caught off guard to find they were not alone. Sitting on the couch along the back wall near the windows was Robert Dayton, the senior senator from Iowa, wearing a seersucker suit and a pale blue bow tie that made Marcus think of his father-in-law. Sitting in a wooden chair to his right was Annie Stewart, wearing a black striped sweater jacket over a white blouse, black slacks, and black flats. The last time he'd seen them was at the memorial service.
"Marcus," said the senator, standing and putting out his hand.
"Senator," Marcus replied, shaking it, and then the woman's. "Miss Stewart?"
"Please call me Annie," she said.
Marcus nodded, and they stood for a moment in an awkward silence. Everyone was looking at Marcus, but he had no intention of saying more. He was being ambushed. Everyone in the room knew it, and he wasn't exactly happy about it. Then Carter piped up and encouraged them all to sit.
"Annie called me this morning," the pastor began. "Said she'd been trying to reach you, but to no avail. Everything okay, Marcus? Phone working properly?"
It was true. She'd left 3 voice messages and sent 2 emails and a text. Marcus had responded to none of them. "Everything's fine, sir," Marcus replied. "And Miss Stewart, Annie, please forgive me. I wasn't trying to be rude. I simply wasn't interested in meeting with the senator. But clearly, we've now passed that point." Annie leaned forward to say something, but the senator took the lead.
"Marcus, I know you've been out of the game for some time, and I respect your reasons," he explained. "But I'm heading for Europe in a few days, and I'd like you to come with me."
"That's very kind, but I need to pass."
"Come on, son," Carter said. "Don't be so quick to say no. We're all friends here. You've known the senator for years. Hear the man out."
49. Marcus looked at his pastor, then back at the senator. "You're running for president," he said. It wasn't a question, but a statement.
"Perhaps," Dayton replied.
"You are. You formed a pack and socked away over $8 million. Dayton raised an eyebrow, clearly surprised he knew such things or cared.
"7 and change, but yes, we'll be at 8 by the end of the month."
"Not hard to do when you're a member of the Senate Finance Committee and the ranking member on the Intelligence Committee," Marcus noted. "You just happen to hail from the state that holds the nation's first caucuses, and you're rising in the early polls, though they hardly mean much. It's all about name recognition at this stage." Dayton was too smooth to take the bait.
"Look, Marcus, I'm heading to Europe because I'm worried about Alexander Luganov," he countered. "More people in this town ought to be, President Clark among them."
Marcus said nothing.
"America's next president needs to understand that as troubled as the Middle East is, and as volatile as North Korea remains, the most serious threat facing the United States, the truly existential threat, comes from Russia," Dayton continued. "It's the Russians who actually have enough nuclear warheads to annihilate 330 million Americans. It's the Russians who actually have the ICBMs to deliver those warheads to our cities. And it's the Russians who are being led by a man who will stop at nothing to rebuild the glory of Mother Russia, hack computers, buy politicians, engage in elaborate disinformation campaigns, arm our worst enemies, even invade small nations in order to intimidate great ones."
"And?" Marcus asked, wondering why any of this should matter to him.
"And the man who is sitting in the White House right now either doesn't get it or, how shall I put this delicately, demonstrates insufficient concern."
"And?"
"And I think it's time to go over and meet some of our friends in London, Brussels, and Berlin, and take a first-hand look at how ready NATO would be to confront Luganov if there were a new leader in the White House. Someone who took the Russian threat a tad more seriously," Dayton said. "I'm leaving Friday afternoon with some of my senior staff, and I'd very much like you to come with me."
"Why?"
"You've worked on plenty of high-level delegations abroad. You know the protocol, and you know the security needs and the logistics."
"With all due respect, sir, plenty of people in this town have done that and more. As you say, I'm out of the game. And honestly, I have no interest in getting back in." The senator looked to Annie.
"Peter Wong recommended you," she said.
The mention of his old Marine buddy blindsided him.
"Pete? What does he have to do with anything?"
Annie looked back at the senator. Dr. Wong has joined my staff as a senior policy advisor.
On foreign policy?
No, that's Annie's portfolio, Dayton said. Dr. Wong is helping me develop a health care plan and a strategy for reforming the VA, along with several other matters. He started with me a couple of months ago. When I told him about this trip, he urged me to take you along.
Senator, I'm flattered, but you can find someone younger to carry your bags.
I don't need someone to carry my bags. I need someone to watch my back, the senator said.
No one in Washington has been more outspoken against Luganov than the senator,
Annie interjected.
He's called him out on the invasion of Georgia and Crimea, plus everything the Russians have been doing in Syria and with Iran, not to mention hacking our elections, throwing dissidents in jail, making reporters disappear.
Still, Marcus didn't bite.
Look, Marcus, everyone knows I'm seriously looking at running for president, Dayton said. Everyone knows foreign policy will be a major component of my campaign, and when I run, if I run, I'll be running directly against Luganov. The man is not just a menace. He poses a clear and present danger to the security of the United States, NATO, and the free world, and that danger is growing. Now, at present, I don't have a security team. Pete is insisting that I start to build one. He wants me to start with you, and I agree. I'd very much like you to come on this trip, keep us all safe, and give me your take on the security situation in Europe while you're at it. That's it. I'm not asking you to join my team full-time. No long-term commitment. Just a robust retainer, along with first-class airfare and first-class accommodations. As you rightly note, we have some money in the pack. Let me use some of it on you, and then you can be back fixing roofs in no time. What do you say?
Marcus had no interest. He didn't agree with Dayton on almost any issue of domestic policy. He could only imagine what nonsense Pete was going to cook up for him. That said, he did share the man's concerns about Luganov, and found him a credible voice on matters of national security, one of the few in the Democratic Party. He also appreciated that neither the senator nor Miss Stewart had brought up the deaths of Elena and Lars in the conversation. They were treating him as a professional, not out of pity. That was classy, and in his experience, all too rare. Standing, he thanked them both for the offer, but politely declined. Then he shook their hands and took his leave, heading back up to the roof. He would skip lunch with the vets. He'd already had far more human contact than he'd wanted for the day. To his relief, Carter did not come find him after the senator left to prod him to reconsider, or even to invite him to lunch. That gave Marcus a good 6 more hours on the roof, alone with his iTunes and his earbuds. It was well past 7 o'clock when he finally headed back to his apartment alone. And someone was waiting for him.
50.
You look terrible, Peter Wong said with a smile.
You look worse, believe me, Marcus replied as he approached the front steps of his building.
I should have expected you'd be here. You're losing your edge, old man.
I probably am, Marcus conceded, as he led Pete upstairs, unlocked his front door, and let them both in.
But Dayton, really? I didn't take you as that desperate.
Pete shrugged.
What can I say? A man made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
But he's an arrogant gas bag.
He's a politician.
My point exactly.
Fair enough. But at least he's a principled gas bag.
At least, Marcus said, as he tossed his keys on the counter and urged Pete to make himself at home.
But come on, you can't really want Bob Dayton to be the next president of the United States, can you? Point me to someone better and I'll sign on tomorrow.
Pete loosened his tie, set his briefcase on a chair, and plopped onto the couch and put his feet up on the coffee table.
Marcus grabbed two bottles of beer from the fridge, handed one to Pete, and put the other by his lazy boy. Then he went back to the kitchen, found a can of mixed nuts in the pantry, opened it, and set it on the coffee table. He slumped in his recliner and reached for the remote.
For crying out loud, Pete, the man's a socialist. He's not a socialist.
Oh yeah, then what is he? A progressive. You mean a liberal? But an honest liberal. I grant you that. He's honest and a good family man, but seriously, does he even have a shot? To shape the debate? Absolutely. To win? I don't know. But hey, he's rising in the polls. It's just name ID right now. But if he wins Iowa and picks up a head of steam going into New Hampshire, who knows? Ask me again in a few months.
Well, tell him to drop the bow ties. He looks ridiculous.
What are you talking about? Your father-in-law wears bow ties. I thought you liked them.
Javier Garcia is a highly sought-after corporate trial lawyer, Pete. Nobody cares what he wears, so long as he wins. Your man wants to be the next commander-in-chief? I'm telling you, drop the bow ties.
Fair enough. I'll see what I can do.
Good. Now tell me you didn't really sign on to do domestic policy for him, Marcus said, turning on the TV and flipping through the channels.
Of course I did, said Pete, taking his first sip of his beer.
Full-time?
You betcha.
And you're really leaving your practice?
Done.
But why?
I mean, after you left the Marines, you became one of the best cardiologists in the country. Why give all that up?
Boredom.
But you're finally making real money for the first time in your life.
I'm bored out of my mind, Marcus. And with the divorce final, most of what I make is just going to alimony after Uncle Sam gets his bite. So really, what's the point?
I'm sorry about Jane.
Hey, what can you do? I should have seen it coming.
You were a good husband and a great dad. Some things aren't meant to be.
Marcus was silent for a moment. Then he switched the channel to the Nats game. The two men watched the entire second inning without saying anything. The Nats were playing the Texas Rangers, and there was no score yet.
So you're moving to Des Moines? Marcus asked when a truck ad came on.
Actually, I just got an apartment here. Moved in a few days ago.
Here in D.C.?
Georgetown?
That's cool.
So we're finally neighbors.
The campaign's going to be run from here, not Iowa?
The PAC is run from here, and technically that's who pays me. We'll see what happens if he pulls the trigger. Right now he's just in an exploratory phase.
Did you let your apartment in San Diego go? I love that place.
Me too. Now I'll hold on to it, Pete replied.
That's the first sensible thing you've said so far.
For now I'm subletting it to one of my nephews. He's a sophomore at San Diego State.
Marcus took another pull on his beer.
Look, buddy, you want the truth? Pete asked.
His tone had suddenly changed. Marcus had heard it before. He muted the television and turned to look at his friend.
Sure. What's the matter?
Nothing's the matter. It's just...
What?
I don't know, man. It's just that when Jane moved out, she went back to Westport. She's got custody of the kids. She took the furniture. I tried to keep living in the apartment, but I couldn't stay. Too many memories. Too many ghosts.
I'm so sorry.
What can you do? Pete said again, returning to his beer.
Anything but politics, Marcus quipped.
Yeah, right. You spent the best years of your life in the White House.
Not doing politics.
Same difference.
It is different. The service is scrupulously apolitical.
Okay, but I've been scrupulously apolitical my whole life, and where's it gotten me?
The country's in trouble, Marcus. Serious trouble.
Someone needs to get us back on the right track. Or try, anyway.
The senators offered me a shot on developing serious reforms, especially on health care and the VA. I decided it was now or never.
Go with never.
Pete ignored him and changed the subject.
So I understand you saw Annie today.
Yeah, why?
What do you mean, why? Pete asked. You don't find her attractive?
Pete, you just got divorced.
Which means I'm back on the market, my friend.
Marcus snorted, shook his head, and turned back to his beer and the game.
Anyway, none of this is the point,
Pete said, munching on some cashews. So what is? It was top of the third. The Nats were rallying. They had runners on first and third with only one out.
You should come with us. Say yes to Dayton.
Why? Marcus asked, as the Nats' leadoff hitter came to the plate.
To get out of the house.
I get out of the house.
No, Marcus, really out. You need a break, a change of pace, of scenery.
Like you? Believe me, buddy, you need it even more than I do.
I'm fine, Pete. But thanks for the concern. No, Marcus, you're not fine. You're depressed and stuck in the mud.
Marcus looked at his friend. No, I'm not. Not anymore.
Yeah, you are. And I'm worried about you. You're not getting past this thing, and you need to.
Getting past it? Marcus asked, suddenly angry. My wife and kid are dead. I'm not getting past anything.
I know. And I'm sorry. It's unspeakable what happened to you, Pete said. But it's not going to get any better by quitting your job, avoiding your friends, dodging your family, and not answering your phone or emails. I mean, seriously, when was the last time you went back to Colorado?
Marcus shrugged.
When's the last time you talked to the Garcias? Or your mom?
Marcus said nothing at first. Just finished off his beer. It's been a few months, but...
I get it, okay? I do. I'm a doctor. And I'm your friend. And I'm telling you, you can't just shut down and hide from the world. When Jane left, I felt like someone had kicked me in the stomach. And yes, I was devastated and furious. I stopped eating. Lost 20 pounds. But I finally realized I needed a change. A change of scenery, a change of pace, people, everything. And Marcus, I'm telling you, you need one too.
51. Marcus said nothing. He just stared at the TV as batter after batter struck out, stranding two runners on base.
The senator called me a few hours ago. He said you told him no, Pete continued. I said I'd take another run at you. So here I am. Come on, Marcus, you know Brussels and Berlin better than anyone. You've certainly been there with the president and VP enough times over the years.
It was true. Marcus thought about the last time he'd done an advance for a G7 summit in London, but then stopped as abruptly as he'd started. He looked at Pete.
Us?
Sorry? Pete asked.
You said come with us, Marcus repeated.
The senator didn't say anything about you going.
He only asked me after you said no,
Pete admitted, setting down his beer and sitting forward on the couch.
Come on, man, what do you say?
Marcus looked back at the television. Now the Rangers were rallying. The first batter up hit a double. The second hit a triple on a high fastball. All right, I'll go, he said finally, turning the television completely off and facing Pete directly. On three conditions.
Who are you, Aladdin?
You gonna hear me out or not?
Fine. Name your price.
First, skip London, Brussels, and Berlin. Been there, done that. It doesn't get you anything. Go to Kiev, Tallinn, Riga, and Vilnius instead.
Why? Asked a bewildered Pete. Most Americans can't even locate those cities on a map.
That's precisely why, Marcus said. If the senator's real concern is the threat posed by Russia, then go talk to people who actually feel threatened by Russia. The British don't. Neither do the Belgians or the Germans. They ought to, but they don't.
Go on. I'm listening.
Every politician with national ambitions goes to 10 Downing Street, especially if you're on the Intelligence Committee. But whoever talks to our most exposed and vulnerable allies? I worked on the PPD for years. We never once went to the Baltics. Yet I hear Luganov just ordered exercises in the Western Military District. And the Ukrainians? After the whole thing in Crimea, everyone's forgotten about them. But the Russians have massed something like 50,000 troops on the Ukrainian border, maybe more. They're saying it's only an exercise. But what if it really is the prelude to an invasion? So get ahead of the story. Meet with the leaders in Kiev. Go see the Ukrainian troops on the front. Take your buddies from CNN and the rest and go make some news. Interesting, Pete conceded. Keep going. Second, go to Moscow. I beg your pardon? You heard me. Ask for a meeting with Luganov in the Kremlin, one-on-one. Marcus, have you lost your mind? Luganov and Dayton hate each other. Everyone knows that. All the more reason to meet with him, mano a mano. Are you going to be the food taster? If I need to be. Marcus, this guy once ordered his people to slip radioactive poison in the tea of one of his political enemies. Unfortunately, Marcus knew, that was true. You want your man to make headlines, right? To show himself a leader? Right, then lead, Marcus insisted. No one else has the guts to confront Luganov. So Dayton should get in his face and tell him he's leading his country down the path of ruin unless he changes course. Then, fly to Brussels and meet with the leaders of NATO. And tell them that unless they get serious about increasing their defense budgets, they're inviting more Russian aggression in Europe. Then, come back to Washington and introduce a bill that imposes sweeping new economic sanctions on Moscow and that adds another $100 billion to the Pentagon's budget. Marcus, you seem to forget one thing. What's that? My guy is a Democrat. All the more reason for him to set himself apart from the appeasement wing of his party. You want to make news, my friend? That'll make news. Pete sat back, trying to process it all. Why would Luganov ever say yes to such a meeting? He asked after a moment. To look tough. What do you mean? To squash your guy like a bug. Thanks a lot. I'm serious, Marcus said. Who is a bigger Russia hawk in the United States Senate than Bob Dayton? The man constantly sounds like he's ready to start a war with Luganov. Never misses a chance to denounce the Kremlin when they deserve it, and arguably even when they don't. No one would expect him to ask for a meeting with Luganov. And no one would ever expect Luganov to say yes, which is probably why he will. Either to woo him and charm him, or to intimidate him and make him look like a deer in the headlights, or to try to make your guy look like a hot-headed blowhard, prone to hyperbole and overreaction. Then again, if Dayton walks away looking like a serious statesman? Now you're getting the picture, Marcus said. Pete finished his beer and looked at his friend. So that's what you've been doing all holed up in this apartment. What? Everyone's worried about you, myself included. But maybe you're not in here grieving. Maybe you're plotting political strategy. I have been grieving, Pete, Marcus said quietly. Doesn't mean I'm depressed. I'm not so sure, Pete replied. But whatever you've been up to, you've given me better ideas in the last 5 minutes. And for free, mind you, that I've given him over the last 2 months for, well, let's just say not for free. So what's your third condition? I'm pretty sure the senator is going to jump at the first two. Marcus smiled for the first time. Promise me that when we get to Moscow, you and I go see Nick and grab a beer. 52. Washington, D.C., September 19th. The group took off from Washington Dulles on Friday afternoon. They did not fly commercial, but rather on a Learjet leased through the Political Action Committee.
Joining the senator were his chief of staff, his press secretary, Annie Stewart, Peter Huang, Marcus, and four former Secret Service members whom Marcus had personally recruited and retained on behalf of the PAC to provide security. Two additional former agents were already on the ground in Kiev, arranging hotel rooms and transportation. Marcus knew full well that he and the other former agents would hardly be able to guarantee the thorough and airtight protection package they all used to provide heads of state. But no American leader as outspoken as the senator on the grave threat posed by Russia could afford not to take at least basic precautions. Pete had also convinced Dayton to switch out his bow ties for a good old-fashioned Windsor knot, another small but noteworthy sign to Marcus that Dayton wasn't simply exploring a run for president. He was already flat-out running. They arrived in Kiev just after 9 a.m. Saturday, local time. The senator and his team were picked up in two armored Chevy Suburbans, driven by the former agents Marcus had sent on ahead, and taken to the Hilton on Tarasa Shevchenko Boulevard. After checking in, showering and changing, the team drove past several lovely parks along the Dnieper River before passing through security gates, continuing up a hill, and arriving at the enormous and historic Mariinsky Palace. There they were taken immediately to the green reception room, as elegant as it was ornate, where they were received by Ukrainian President Dmitry Davchenko under a large crystal chandelier.
"Senator Dayton, thank you for coming to Kiev. You are most welcome,"
Davchenko began, as a small group of Ukrainian and American reporters and photographers recorded the moment. "It's an honor to be here, Mr. President. Especially now," Dayton said, as the cameras clicked away.
"Your support for us in the U.S. Senate means a great deal to us, as does your willingness to come all this way to meet with me. The situation on our eastern border is growing critical, and we need faithful friends like yourself."
"In such times as these, we need good leaders with great courage, do we not?" asked the senator.
"We do indeed."
"The words of Sir Winston Churchill come to mind," Dayton said, playing for the cameras. "The belief that security can be obtained by throwing a small state to the wolves is a fatal delusion."
"Hear, hear."
"Mr. President," Dayton continued, "I cannot account for why the White House isn't doing more to stand with you, but I vow to do my best to push our president and my colleagues in the Senate to do as much as possible. This is why I've come."
Davchenko bade the members of the press corps farewell, then led the senator and his aides through a side door to a book-lined study where they were served tea. After some pleasantries, they quickly got to the heart of the matter.
"I'm hearing reports that some 50,000 Russian troops are currently conducting exercises close to your territory," Dayton said. "Is this accurate?"
"Unfortunately, no. The number is considerably higher,"
Davchenko replied.
"As of this morning, Luganov has amassed more than 100,000 men and more than 1,000 battle tanks on our borders. Squadrons of bombers and fighter jets have been redeployed from the Asian theater to the military district immediately adjacent to us. And the number of Russian intrusions into our sovereign airspace has quadrupled in the past 2 weeks.
"Have you talked directly to President Clark about all this?"
"We spoke briefly when I congratulated him on his election,"
Davchenko replied uncomfortably.
"We spoke again last week for a bit longer. The president assured me he considers Ukrainian freedom a major priority."
"Has he invited you to the White House?"
"Not yet."
"But he's promised to send more aid."
"Yes, well, a bit. But non-lethal assistance only, I'm afraid."
"What about the heavy arms and ammunition you've been asking for?"
"Let's just say the president was non-committal,"
said the Ukrainian leader.
"I will tell you what I told him. We are not asking for American or NATO troops to shed a single drop of blood for us. We are ready to fight the Russians alone. But give us the means to defend ourselves with honor.
Dobzhenko leaned forward in his seat and lowered his voice.
Senator, I know you are familiar with the Budapest Memorandum, but how many other Americans are?
Very few, I'm afraid.
Then I ask you to educate them,
Dobzhenko said.
They need to understand that when the Soviet Union collapsed in December of 1991, we in Ukraine possessed almost 2,000 nuclear warheads. At that time, your president, along with the British Prime Minister, insisted that we turn these warheads over to Russia to be dismantled and destroyed. As you can understand, we were highly reluctant. Those weapons provided us a guarantee, perhaps our only guarantee, that we would never be reinvaded and reoccupied by the Russians. But Washington and London pushed us hard to give them up in return for so-called security assurances, including assurances that Moscow would respect our sovereignty and borders. On December 5, 1994, my predecessor signed the agreement in Budapest.
Dobzhenko paused for effect.
Senator, Ukraine kept its part of the deal. We gave up our nuclear weapons, all of them. But Moscow has broken its word. They have annexed Crimea. They have seized parts of our eastern territory. And they are preparing to come for the rest of us. They would never have done so if we were a nuclear-armed power. We are not, because your country and the British persuaded us to give up those weapons with the promise that you would never let us be threatened, much less invaded, by the Russians. Yet here we sit. Forgive my bluntness, but your president does nothing.
President Dobzhenko, this is a significant reason I am actively considering running for president myself, said the senator. I see what Luganov is up to. I want to strengthen NATO, and I want to help you, with arms, with intelligence, with whatever you need, so you can defend yourselves, by yourselves.
This is all very well and good, Senator, and believe me, I and my people are grateful for your wisdom and your courage. But let us be frank. I will not get involved in your presidential campaign. I cannot afford to play partisan politics. Time is of the essence. I agreed to meet with you in hopes that you will take a personal message back to the president, back to Congress, and back to the American people. The Russian bear is awake, and he is hungry. He is on the prowl. Our very lives and freedom are at risk. You made us promises. You must keep them. I implore you, sir, keep them now.
53. En route to Tallinn, Estonia, September 21st. Dobzhenko is right, Dayton said, after they lifted off from Kiev. We need to figure out how to help him.
No, sir, he's not right, not entirely,
Annie replied. Marcus looked up from a text he was writing to Nick Vinetti in Moscow. What do you mean? The senator asked. The Ukrainians did give up their nukes in return for American and British security guarantees. Now they're about to be overrun by the Russians, and the White House is AWOL.
It's not that simple, sir.
Sure it is, Pete interjected. Look, this isn't just a strategic issue, it's a moral one. America doesn't cut our allies loose. Yet that's exactly what Clark has done. And if you position yourself right, Senator, you can use this to show that Clark has no idea what he's doing when it comes to foreign policy.
Annie, Pete's right, Dayton said.
No, sir, he's not.
Annie pushed back firmly but respectfully. Why not?
For starters, Ukraine is not an ally, she replied. A friend, yes, but an ally, no. Second, reread the Budapest Memorandum. There's no question the Russians pledged to respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And there's also no question that they have clearly and repeatedly broken that pledge. But nowhere in that document does the U.S. explicitly promise to go to war with Russia to defend Ukraine. Nor does it explicitly commit an American president to provide weapons and other war materiel to Ukraine if the agreement is violated. It's not a treaty. And if it were, it never would have been ratified by the Senate, not in 1994, and certainly not now. What are you saying? Pete asked, becoming far more animated about this than Marcus would have imagined. Are you suggesting Clark is right to cut the Ukrainians loose to the likes of Alexander Luganov? No, of course not. Then what? I'm suggesting the senator would be wise to tread with extreme caution and not publicly commit himself to war with Russia in order to protect Ukraine, she replied. Don't get me wrong. I feel for Dovzhenko and his people. Believe me, I do.
But, Pete pressed.
But the truth is we simply do not have a treaty obligation to Kiev. We do have one with the Baltics, though. In a few hours, Senator, you'll be sitting with the Estonian Prime Minister. Estonia is a member of NATO. If the Russians were to move against Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania, then the U.S. would have a legal obligation to defend them. Yet even this raises a critical question, sir, especially for a progressive Democrat like yourself.
Which is?
Are you sure you are willing to risk a nuclear war with Russia to defend three countries that few Americans have ever heard of? On top of that, are you really ready to go to war to defend a country with whom we don't even have a treaty? And either way, how exactly are you going to sell that to the Democratic Party and win your party's nomination?
They arrived at Tumpea Castle just in time for their noon meeting. The castle, built around the 13th century, was a mammoth structure surrounded by a high stone wall. After a brief photo op, similar to the one in Kiev, Prime Minister Voldemar Janssen invited Dayton and the team to join him for lunch, along with the ministers of defense and foreign affairs. As soon as lunch was served, Janssen got down to business.
My intelligence chiefs tell me Luganov has positioned more than 50,000 Russian combat soldiers on our border, in addition to the 100,000 troops he's positioned in Belarus and on the borders of Ukraine. In addition, he's moved 400 battle tanks and 15 squadrons of bombers and fighters within striking distance of us and our Baltic neighbors. The Kremlin says it's an exercise, but my advisers say it's the prelude to war.
We heard similar concerns in Kiev, the senator replied.
I'm sure you did, but you don't have a treaty with Kiev. You do have one with us.
And we will honor it, Dayton said, without hesitation.
Marcus glanced at Annie, who kept a poker face.
Will you, Senator? The Prime Minister asked. I don't mean to be undiplomatic, but your precedent seems awfully vague about Article 5.
Unfortunately, that's true. And that's one of the reasons I'm considering running.
The Prime Minister shifted in his seat.
Senator, I hope you will not be offended when I say this.
No, of course not.
Whether you run for the presidency of your country or not is of little concern to me and my colleagues. We cannot wait for a new American president. Tallinn is less than 200 miles from the Russian border. I need the man who sits in the White House right now to step up and give us a decisive and demonstrative show of support before it's too late.
I hear you, Dayton said. And I'm heading to Brussels in a few days. I'm going to deliver a major speech calling for all NATO countries to step up and fulfill their obligations to invest at least 2% of their GDP on annual defense expenditures, as stated in the NATO Accord.
I appreciate that, Senator, I do. We absolutely need every NATO country to do their fair share. We certainly are, and more. Our defense spending has hit 2%, and usually more, nearly every year since Estonia gained membership in NATO in 2004. But again, as important as shining a spotlight on this investment issue is, it's not going to help much if the Russians invade next week or next month.
I take your point, Dayton said. What specifically do you need, Mr. Prime Minister?
What do I need? Janssen asked. For starters, why isn't NATO flowing in combat brigades, tanks, fighter jets, and anti-aircraft missiles, not just here, but throughout the Baltics? The Russians have put together an overwhelming force. By all evidence, they are training for an invasion right now. Tomorrow, I will take you to the border. I will introduce you to my top generals. I will show you the current disposition of forces. But what have Washington, or London, or Brussels, or Berlin done in response? They've issued meaningless condemnations of Luganov, and vague statements of support for the Baltics. What I need is troops and heavy weapons, not more words.
Again, that is precisely why I have come, Mr. Prime Minister, to see the situation for myself and be able to sound the alarm throughout Europe and back in Washington.
Good, Janssen said. We're not getting many representatives from Washington coming through the Baltics these days, and we're grateful for every friend we can find over there. But may I be even more candid with you, Senator?
Of course. At this, the Prime Minister leaned close to Dayton and lowered his voice, such that Marcus had to strain to hear every word, even though he was sitting with Annie and Pete just a few feet away.
Please take this message back directly to President Clark. At this moment, the very existence of my country hangs in the balance. And I must tell you, the existence of NATO itself is very much in jeopardy.
Go on.
If the Russians invade Ukraine, that's horrible. But it doesn't obligate Washington to take action,
Janssen said, almost in a whisper.
But if Luganov invades the Baltics, Article 5 kicks in. If you honor your treaty obligations, then you and the rest of NATO have to come to war to drive out the Russians and re-establish our independence. But let's be brutally honest. If Russians and Americans start killing each other, Luganov is going to use tactical battlefield nuclear weapons. When that happens, many Estonians, Latvians and Lithuanians will die in a millisecond. Millions more will die horrifying deaths in the days and weeks that follow. And it won't be just us. NATO forces will die as well, including Americans. Then your president will be faced with the ultimate worst-case scenario. Will he retaliate against Moscow and other Russian cities with ICBMs and nuclear weapons? If he does, he knows he runs the risk of setting into motion a global thermonuclear war, which will lead to the deaths of hundreds of millions. But if he backs down and chooses not to honor the NATO treaty, Then he is signing the death sentence, not just for us, but for all of NATO. What's more, he'll be creating a monster. Alexander Luganov will have not only seized the border,